You're listening to a podcast by BI Norwegian Business School.
Welcome back to Stay Ahead, a BI Norwegian Business School podcast. This episode is part of the Strategy as Practice series, where practice meets theory and theory meets practice. Today's topic is, how can business regain trust and align a bigger purpose with shareholder interests? Today, I have the pleasure of having with me Helge Lund, Chairman of BP and Novo Nordisk. BP is among the five biggest energy companies in the world, and Novo Nordisk, a world-leading pharmaceutical company. He became chairman of Novo Nordisk in 2018 by being on the board since 2014 and chairman of BP in 2019. Helge served as chief executive of the British oil and gas company BG Group from 2015 to 2016 when it merged with Shell. Prior to joining BG Group, he served as chief executive officer for 10 years at today's called Equinor, at that time called Statoil. Welcome.
Thank you, Thomas.
I'm also joined by Lars Humer, professor in strategy and entrepreneurship at BI since 2009. Actually, you joined in 1999. His research includes cooperative strategy, value creation, networks, and trust. He also teaches in topics including strategic management and supply chain management. He is also the Associate Dean for the Executive Energy Master Program, a joint program between BI and IFP School in Paris. Welcome.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
My name is Thomas Morgan, and I'm an industrial PhD candidate at the Department of Strategy and Entrepreneurship here at BI, and will be your host today. Let's start off, Helge. You're now a chairman and non-executive after being through a very impressive executive career. What are your learnings from such a transition?
Well, Thomas, I think to take on that different role, you have to reflect on the fact that you really want it and that you are conscious that this is a different role and perhaps a couple of differences. One is I feel that the board responsibility is to take even longer lenses on. I mean, really think about the long term. Executive teams are under immense pressure every day, every week, every quarter. There's a lot of noise, a lot of issues to be handled every day. We need to lift a little bit above that and help the team think about the longer term. The other thing is the support dimension of being on the board. I think you're a little bit more in the background. You can maybe be effective in trying to support the CEO and the team a little bit more from a backseat than from the back road. And maybe you see different things when you're a little bit away from the day-to-day activities.
Mm. Is it a strength or a challenge to have been a very successful CEO, operative CEO for so many years to be able to take that back seat?
You know, this is something that you have to think about. But I actually think it is an advantage for a board member to have had the shoes on and that you know some of the pressures that that the team is sensing every day.
Exactly. Sounds right. Lars, you've been a professor in Chile, Australia, US, three very different continents. Any common or specific learnings you have taken back to BI with you?
Well, Thomas, all occasions have good wine.
Exactly.
But seriously, Australia was fantastic for my PhD writing. A dear colleague had finished her thesis on trust a few years earlier, so that was very valuable. Chile was great for the aquaculture project. And, Berkeley is Berkeley.
Very good, very good. Helge, I will start off by asking you, business role in society and trust in business, has it changed? And maybe how and why, do you think?
I think we have to realize that over the last few decades, trust in big institutions have been challenged. I think it goes with government institutions as well as business. And to some extent, it's a bit challenging in the sense that the business, I think, can solve problems that no other institution can solve in terms of taking risk, allocating capital, doing innovation, scaling up of capital and organizing for efficiency. And over the last 40, 50 years, I think globalization, capitalism, effective business have created massive opportunities, massive wealth for the world. On the other hand, we have to realize that, that success have come with, societal costs, climate change, environmental degradation, social tensions in many societies, inequalities is much discussed. And I think some of that have led to decreasing trust in companies. And from time to time, people reflect on, and I reflect on, that perhaps we have been over the last few decades too focused on one dimension, i.e. serving shareholders, and have been, too little focused on other stakeholders and what kind of problems you're really solving for the society. I mean, going back to the issue around what is the purpose of the enterprise and the company.
But let's then go back to a Nobel Prize winner, economist Milton Friedman, who famously stated, I think it was an article in the 1970s, that the only social responsibility of a business is to increase its profits. So that's a wrong statement then, is it?
I think actually that Friedman's thinking have been impacting many corporate leaders and maybe the majority of us over the last 40, 50 years. And of course, capitalism and that way of thinking, as I said, has created a lot of wealth in that period, but it also led to many other challenges. And I think now the debate we have, and I think the increasing focus on the fact that big companies have other roles to play as well in a society has been a healthy one, and it's an important one to think about in a deeper way. How do you take care of your people? How do you deal with the external impact on the activities of the company? How do you deal with suppliers and ultimately also the customer in a bigger way than we have done in the past? I think that's healthy. It's an important debate, and I actually think it will bring companies and capitalism closer to society, which can only be for being a good thing.
So basically, we have to bury, to some extent, the Milton Friedman doctrine and move beyond that, as you kind of allude to.
I think that's important, not to forget about profit, not to forget about performance. I think actually that's incredibly important. But how could we, to a larger extent, connect the purpose of enterprises to societal problems and help solve those problems profitably. So in one way, being purpose-led, but driven by performance, I think then you have an unbeatable model. Yeah.
That's a fascinating statement. Lars, what's your take on this?
Obviously, I agree with Helge's emphasis on the importance of corporations and the value creation that they can achieve in a very unique way. So we cannot drop profit and we cannot drop performance in any way. But I would also agree with the fact that the Friedman doctrine is narrow-minded. We need to get a better equilibrium on means and ends. There are many different stakeholders out there and many different sources of value creation. Profit is one of these. Another Nobel laureate, Amartya Sen has done his reading of Adam Smith, who is maybe then at times seen as the grandfather of Milton Friedman. And we have his famous, the butcher, the brewer, and the baker. And it's not from their benevolence that we get our dinner, but from regard of their own self-interest. But he actually claims that if when you do the reading carefully of Adam Smith, there's nothing in his writings that suggests that he put any particular emphasis on self-interest, that would be the clue to economic salvation. He also wrote The Theory of Moral Sentiments. So we can go back in time and find good inspiration for a more balanced view of how we actually can co-create different types of values, firms being one important stakeholder in this.
Lars, I think this is an important topic, and there are some developments, I think, over the last few decades that is important in that context. We have seen a rapid development of globalization, and also a acceleration in technology development. Mm. And therefore, I think there could be a regulatory gap, a political gap, where actually regulators are not able to catch up with those developments. So in some sense, it puts more pressure on companies to be values-driven and actually self-regulate themselves in terms of operating on a global scale. Mm. So it drives, I think, the importance of ethics, of good values, of being a responsible corporate citizen in this in this context.
Yeah, I would agree. It's to see the bigger picture, and maybe on the board you have time to do that and can help the CEOs. As you say, they have other daily pressures. There's another. I know we've had a podcast on artificial intelligence and digital strategy, and then you really have to sort of be in the forefront. But when it comes to these issues are basic and human, have been around for quite some time. There's another scholar which I find fascinating. Her name was Mary Parker Follett. She was actually a social worker, operative for about 100 years ago. And there's a Mary Parker Follett Society in Japan. She gained traction there more than here. And one of her messages was that she said that I don't believe that we have economic problems, ethical problems, or psychological problems. We have human problems with economic dimensions, psychological dimensions, and ethical dimensions. So if we could, there's also, we can help leaders to see that those interdependencies that the decisions they take and we teach are broad and have important implications, then maybe we can add something, bring something to the table.
Yeah.
But just for our listeners to clarify, and I'm sure you have a take on this, Helge, or even Lars, there's been for quite some time a discussion about triple bottom line, CSR, and now we maybe bring in purpose. What's the difference, and how is the kind of the pyramid being built up? What's your take on that?
So I think in many ways that the purpose is trying to explain why does this organization exist? What are the problems they are set up and designed to solve? And perhaps to make it less theoretical, we can talk about the company that I chair in Denmark. Novo Nordisk is a fantastic company, and they're actually built on an innovation that happened roughly 100 years back, the discovery of insulin that, was life-saving for people with diabetes. So basically, they've had the same purpose to defeat diabetes and other chronic diseases for almost 100 years. And this was basically a tiny little Danish company, 40, 50 years back, competing basically in the Nordic region. And now the company is a global institution, market cap around $250 billion by any standard, the biggest company in the Nordic region. And they have basically grown organically in that period. And all the time driven by the same purpose. And I tend to think that that very razor sharp purpose has led to very clear strategic choices when you're facing dilemmas. You have been able to recruit people with a passion for science. And that in itself has led to perhaps a higher degree of innovation than in other companies. That, and then ultimately that has led to superior products, high sales, you know, helping more people, and then become more profitable. And you can reinvest in R&D and innovation. And they have continued on this path. So I think it's an excellent example of how actually purpose can impact companies in a big way, and also the very strong link in this sense between purpose, performance, and profit, and you need all of them actually together.
So basically, purpose is at the top of the hierarchy, and then some of the other terminologies being the triple bottom line CRS is just supporting ordinary business. Is that how I should read your comment?
Absolutely, Thomas. But I think you have. In order really to have an impact and for a purpose really to direct your troops and help position the company, you need to actually let purpose also help you make decisions. Because there are certain things you're not doing due to your purpose, and there are things that you will do an emphasis more because you have that particular purpose. So I think it's to move it from being something that you advertise to something that you bring into the boardroom, you bring it into the executive team. It helps you actually making decisions.
There's research on what's called identity theory. So being the theory of who we are. Most of our theories focus on activities, what we do, or resources, what we have. But identity theory is then more about who we are. And that theory would indicate, just like you're saying, Helge, that such an awareness can help you to take strategic decisions. It helps you to notice what's going on in the environment and what's doable and what's not doable. So that can be absolutely important. Back to your issue, Thomas, on triple bottom line and CSR, my take on that would be that I mean, it can get very confusing and you have many perspectives and views. As long as it's, I think CSR or these triple bottom lines are integrated in what the board, how the board thinks and how the CEO and management actually performs their daily duties, not that it becomes sort of an attached makeup. And then we have the CSR thing, or then we have the other bottom lines, but they are ingrained in like the Mary Parker Follett quote, they are part of the decisions that we make in an inherent way, then maybe it helps.
I think it's a great point, Lars. And to some extent, during my time as a leader in many companies, I think I've seen that triple bottom line sustainability issues have moved from being, and corporate social responsibility has moved from being something on the sideline into the core part of your business. And sustainability in many ways has become strategy and the other way. Around, we had, as an example, we had a strategy board meeting in BP in September where we were discussing, you know, the way forward for the company. And I think more than 50% of the agenda time in that strategy meeting was exactly around these issues and more specifically, how do we deal with, you know, scope one, scope two, scope three sort of ambitions and targets, and how did that impact strategic choices and strategic direction? So it's almost impossible today to divide between these two you know, perspectives. They're deeply integrated.
Right.
You mentioned Novo Nordisk. We've been a chairman now for a couple of years, but also BP, which is going through a tremendous change. It is fascinating to read the very ambitious transition BP is going through. But when you launched that strategy back in, I think it was 2020. And that just a week after revealing the plant, actually, the share price went to its all-time 25-year low. How did you feel about that when you launched a new, very remake strategy about sustainability in particular?
Well, I think everyone would like to have a favorable reception of a strategic direction, and it's always better with a high than a low share price.
Yeah.
But I think we launched that strategy and a very significant change in a very peculiar time, in the sense that we had COVID came more or less at the same time, and then the energy prices collapsed. So I think every energy company, at least with the dominating position in oil and gas, had a really tough time in 2020. But I think, and going back to what we discussed earlier on purpose and strategic direction and the long-term perspective, we have seen since then that there is an increasing understanding of the strategic choices that we made. And I think 2 years back, that strategy was seen as very, very radical. I don't think it is anymore. I think there are other companies who have sort of not replicated, but developed their own sort of energy transition strategy. And I feel now, speaking with the biggest investors of BP, great support for the transition that we have made. And it's up to us now to show that we can deliver year by year. And I think, going back to the purpose, again, this is not a 1 or 2 years transition in energy for companies or for the society. This is a multi-decade transition. And again, then, you know, pointing back to the importance of a board having the long-term perspective, and how do you best protect the institution to make it survive and prosper and develop in the long term. And it was inconceivable for the board to think that we would survive and prosper just staying where we were in 2019. We had to make a change because we deeply believe that the energy markets would change over time.
It's amazing just reading through the ambitious plan you have and making it from, let's call it, an oil and gas company to an integrated energy company. You're leading a master program, executive energy master program. Listening to the chairman of one of the world's largest integrated energy company, how will that impact the teaching and the way you frame the syllabus, for example? And what's your reflection on this?
We're thinking about, the program is working very well. It's, I think, our most global program at the school. And we have this fruitful relationship with the IFP in Paris. The redesign that we have in mind now is, I would link it to sort of the idea of a shared destiny and more interdependencies. The program so far has been very focused on the supply side. So our students are in oil and gas, and they want to make oil and gas more sustainable. Or I think the majority are leaving oil and gas towards renewables. But we haven't anything on the demand side. And as now we have Helge, one of the experts, the true experts in the field. But I think, so I'm curious about your opinion on this, but I think we need to include the demand side. We need to understand how energy is being used and consumed in transportation, in construction, in textile. So we need to get a balance on the consumption side as well. So I would like to have maybe a course or two where we add to this, and maybe where the expression CEO in the future will also implies chief energy officer. We need people with energy competence in many areas. So I think that could be one of the, both to grow the program, but maybe it would make sense sort of to increase sustainability.
It's a great point, Lars. And I think we all understand that in order to be successful, in order to transition the society in terms of energy, we have to look at supply and demand. And it's easier, I think, for the world and for regulators and politicians to focus on the supply side, because you have certain big companies that is easy to target, and we have to do our share.
Mm.
And we are doing it now. And I sense a deep commitment in these companies actually to do the transition. And going back to purpose, we changed the purpose of BP to reimagining energy for the people and the planet, and moving it from actually being to maximize profit for shareholders. And that comes with some dilemmas and some tough...
That is quite a transition.
Decisions, it is. I mean, some of the decisions that we have made is, for instance, over the next 10 years to reduce oil and gas production by 40%. That's one. We have decided not to enter into new countries to do exploration. We have pulled out of certain trade associations because they're not sort of in line with the purpose and the direction of BP. And we've also stopped all corporate reputation campaigning and instead redirected those resources into advocacy for good climate regulations, i.e. CO2 prices and other takes, because that is has a link to the purpose that we have, and we would not have been credible unless we did choices like that. But it has not been easy, and it has taken a lot of discussions internally before we came to those conclusions. Mm.
No, I imagine that the profit purpose balance is challenging. One of the projects I worked on was in the salmon farming aquaculture industry, and well, imagine that we are in the west coast of Vancouver Island. So it's a very beautiful area on the UNESCO World Heritage site, popular by many different stakeholders for different reasons. And then you put on the salmon farming manager glasses and you look out at this beautiful ocean and you see profit. That's what you see. And it makes sense to see that. So happened that Cermaq, one of the leading salmon farming companies, was Norwegian at the time when I did the study, now Japanese. One of their subsidiaries, Mainstream, they had 50% of their farming in indigenous territory, some First Nation, which is the North American expression, land. Now, if you put on the glasses of the First Nation, of the indigenous people, you don't see profit, you see purpose. You see your history, you see your past, you see a possible, hopefully a future, you see sacred sites, you see seasonal sources of food. To combine... of course, these different stakeholders didn't work well for a long period of time. But I found it interesting and intriguing to follow their relationship because they eventually managed to sign a protocol contract, an agreement of how they could co-create value together. But with intense challenges, of course, when you see so dramatically different things. You mentioned time, multi-decade transitions. I think one really fantastic part of this protocol agreement was the time horizon of the First Nation. They wanted this to be a good partnership for seven generations. Mm. Now we're talking sustainability for real.
Mm. But Lars, you're talking about stakeholders, and I think one stakeholder group which is often overlooked is your own people. So when I joined BP in 2018, one of the first things I did was actually to tour the world to meet people around in the company. Town hall meetings, smaller groups, leadership teams. And it was a very, very strong call for change. And one of the most frequent questions was, how could we help the world in a bigger way to do the energy transition.
Mm.
And to me, after that year of touring the organization, I was convinced that we had to change. We had to change more radically, simply to be able to attract the right type of skills and individuals coming to the company, particularly among young people. And I'm almost certain that some of the people that we have recruited over the last few years, young people, fantastic capabilities, enormously purpose-driven, a lot of energy, would never, ever have had come to BP unless they had seen that clearer purpose. Because I think most people would like to do something that is meaningful for society and go to work and feel that, that they're making progress, not only for the company, but perhaps also for the society and for, in a broader terms, the world. And when I ask these people today, why do you, did you enjoy or come to a company like BP, almost universally, they answer that if we are successful, we can not only impact BP, but also much broader, which is, I think, increasingly important in a very, very tough talent market.
I would agree. The notion of a sort of a shared destiny and goal alignment. Our theories, I think, too often emphasize win-lose battles, and we're intrigued by the notion of competitive advantage, which is sort of a firm-level construct, too often not acknowledging the aspects of value co-creation. So we also have our share to do in terms of how we teach and educate future leaders in how to see this.
But just to follow up on your comment, Helge, about the enormous transition BP is going through and are in the midst of it, one has to say, and going from the statement that profits is first, that purpose is now going first, have been an oil and gas company for more than 100 years, close to 70,000 employees, I think. It can't just be an easy road to that transition. I mean, what's the challenges and dilemmas one has to expect on that transition and on that road?
So it has been and is very challenging. So we have changed purpose, we have changed strategy, we have retired the traditional way of organizing oil and gas companies in an upstream and a downstream business, reflecting the changes we are doing. We have changed the leadership team, basically all of them. We have done a massive restructuring organizationally. Unfortunately, I had to say goodbye to 10,000 people. That's 25% of the office-based workers in the company. So this has been a tough journey, but it has been necessary to put the company in a competitive position in a very rapidly changing an energy market. One of the biggest issues that we are debating, and I don't think there is a clear answer to that, and that is the pace of the transition, because I think we see, and you alluded to that earlier, it's almost impossible, or it is impossible in a few years to get rid of oil and gas, because it's the society, global community is deeply dependent on oil and gas. So you have to live with that for many decades. So in that context, how fast do you do the transition as an individual company? And BP had its experience in the 90s where they actually made significant investments into renewables at that time. Very, very significant investments, but they were too early because the market was not there and the society was not there either, and therefore they had to take big impairments and big write-downs because they were too early on. So also the transition has to be in some sort of sync with how fast the society is going. But at least we have concluded that we want to be one of the leaders and not one of the laggards in the area. But it's tough, it's hard, but I think we have much higher conviction now, 2 years in, than we had 2 years back, because when you're launching something like this, it takes some courage.
We're actually using a case from BP and Vivian Cox in one of our master programs on that energy transition and her leadership approach. So,
But Lars, I think in one of your recent research, you emphasized how actually what Helge alluded to, a recombination of resources that can give better value to corporations. What is this kind of analytical framework you're proposing in your work?
I guess the key word again would be interdependence, and to be self-critical about what we or how we perceive the world as academics is that we maybe tend to pretend independence more than interdependence. So what we're trying to do in this article is to go to complement a very seminal piece of work by Professor Jay Barney and the resource-based view, very famous tools called Vrin and Vrio. Basically, they say that a strategic resource has to be rare and difficult to imitate. And these resources are approached from independently. So we look at single resources and get that belief that the single resource has an inherent value. So we're trying to rethink that. For instance, if we look at the transportation of garbage in Oslo, if you look at what it says on the trucks that pick up your garbage, it says verditransport. So it's value transportation. Usually garbage is not seen as a strategic resource. But from an energy perspective, we can explain why we, a few years back, imported 70,000 tons of garbage from the UK to Oslo. So in essence, we're trying to redefine what a strategic resource is in terms of value creation. Take the current COVID situation, for instance. For the single company, it would be fantastic if the vaccine they had was rare and difficult to imitate. I mean, I would have, as usually, missed buying shares in that company because their shares would skyrocket, right? But from a societal perspective, the last thing we want from a COVID vaccine is that it is rare and difficult to imitate. That will not create value on a societal level. So we're saying that a strategic resource is not rare and difficult to imitate. A strategic resource is a resource that matches with other resources and make those resources better. Easily stated, you could think of the expression MVP, which stands for the most valuable player. It's not an award for the best player, but it's an award for the player that makes the team better. So we need tools and frameworks that really help us to see interdependencies and not believing that garbage is garbage. Garbage is a good thing, used in the right way.
I think your thinking brings us also, I think, into a perhaps underestimated topic, which is around trust. Because companies do not exist in isolation and in terms of operating independent sort of circles, you have to have trust. And then we're back to where we started this conversation. If you have a clear purpose, people understand why you exist, you have clear values in the company that you run, you have a perspective beyond yourself and beyond your own profit, also on your value chain and those around you, including the bigger society. Mm. I think it's much easier to build and develop and retain trust, which is an incredibly important factor in an interdependent world, as we all know that we are operating in.
Yes, absolutely. And trust has, of course, been the million-dollar question for me for decades. It is a linking to purpose. One of the key dimension probably that research has shown is integrity. So we have integrity, we have competence, and we have benevolence. Recent research shows that in terms of reducing transaction cost, integrity was 10 times more important. It's easier to fix someone's competence than to fix their integrity. But it's a peculiar resource, no? It's described both as a glue, ties us together, but it's also a lubricant, so it makes things run smoother. It can take decades to build, and you ruin it in seconds. So you really have to be careful when you work with and use this very valuable resource.
Yeah. If you go back in and read about the history of corporations, I mean, if you go many, many, many hundred years back, it's interesting to see that the concept of a corporation was always linked to solving a societal problem. I mean, collect garbage, collect taxes, whatever it it was. And maybe the last 50 years, and driven by the maybe Friedman doctrine, we have been a little bit on departed from that sort of thinking and that line of thinking about corporations. So I think now perhaps we are moving back to having a broader view on the role of the corporation, actually linking it in a deeper way to solving societal problems. I think it's extremely interesting to note that a conversation with an investor in BP and Novo Nordisk today is not that different from a conversation that we have with some of our people, young people, because they increasingly want the same thing.
Mm.
They want a company with a clear purpose. They want a company that thinks beyond themselves and take care of more stakeholders, but ultimately is profitable as well. I.e., back to, you know, this being purpose-led and performance-driven. So I see there is a pretty strong momentum towards that line of thinking. We can debate why this happened, this development over the last few years. Was it the financial crisis in 2018? Was it or is it the climate change challenge? Is it the rapid technology development that we talked about? Mm. Is it globalization? I don't know what it is, but it seems that there is a development towards a more comprehensive way of thinking about the role of companies in societies. And I think it's interesting to reflect on the fact that it's really hard to come up with a societal issue where you do not need companies or business to solve it. It could be a big or a small issue, but business is part of basically every solution to societal problems. And in order to increase the scope for business, I think trust is incredibly important. So we're back to that.
Mm.
Very good. What I read you saying, both of you, this is a fundamental change taking place, and we're in the midst of it. We can always discuss and speculate the reasons behind it, but there is obviously a need for it. And here we have both from the academic world and from the practical world seeing that we're working towards it. But we have to adjust how we work with businesses. We have to work how we work with students and academia. But I think we are on the same track here. This has been a fascinating conversation, a very, very important topic. Thank you, Helge, for taking time out of your very busy schedule. And thank you, Lars, for joining us today. And see you next time, and all the best.
Thank you, Thomas. Thank you, Helge. Thank you.
This is a BI production. Listen to more podcasts. Go to bi.no/podcasts.